paramis are essential to Buddhist understanding and practice. And when Fred mentioned that we're going to be reflecting on these ancient teachings and looking how they apply now, I had that sense of joy that we're reflecting on something that still has life and still has a range of exploration for us that will effectively take all our time. So from the Buddhist point of view, if you're comfortable with the idea of rebirth consciousness, then it's considered that the paramis are already present in the rebirth consciousness, and that effectively each time we are born with the good fortune of hearing the Dhamma, then these are act as merits that then emerge, and they become an underlying experience that is a fortification of so many aspects of our growing maturity. And when I talk about growing maturity, I want to refer to a term that's associated with the paramis, which is becoming a truly and supremely reasonable person. Parami, or para, is translated as supreme. And it's supreme in the sense that it is transcendent, that as we keep these virtues and these forces of clarification and purification in mind, then what that does is just by the nature of the contemplation of these qualities, they arise as virtues that help us to become more efficient, I want to say, in living in alignment and in accordance with the Dhamma. And when I say, I mean efficient, I mean that they become more a part of the frequency of our consciousness, so that over time they become a part of our reasoning process. There is a wonderful sense of irony throughout all the teachings of the Buddha, because we hear about things like Gate, gate, parasamgate, parasamgate bodhisvaha, which is, you know, this essentially, you know, through the paramis that one is gone, 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 gate, gate. And in fact, one of the translations of a slightly different spelling of parami connotes this going beyond. And yet, in order for us to go beyond, we have to first be here. And so there's a kind of confusion that I think is less promoted in the Theravadin practice than any of the others, because there's less of an esoteric sense of all of this. This is really bare bones, which is the reason that I was drawn to it, because this is a practical understanding of the teachings. So we can look at the paramis as aspects of a practical, contemplative, and applicable way of being, even though they have this transcendent possibility. The transcendence is inadvertent. It's not something that we shoot for, you know. And that's where the clarity associated with this practice and the understanding of the paramis is so extremely helpful, because we don't shoot for anything. We really just gather the force of our attention throughout this life, like harvesting it, you know, out of confusion and delusion, and reallocate it. And through the process of the surrendering of our attention into present time awareness, and then it's here, in this kind of field, field of a more cohesive energy of mind, that we began to really see and understand what a purposeful, intentional life is. So one way that I look at our unique manifestation here in, as human beings, is that we are intentional beings. And our attentional and intentional intersection is aided tremendously by a practical understanding of the paramis. So although transcendent, supreme, implying going beyond, they actually also ground us in a manner that allows for us to become reasonable human beings. And as I've gotten older, I want to say, but not older in the sense, as my practice, the life of my practice has gotten more mature, that's really become more of the aspiration, is to become reasonable, to be able to process clearly. And in that ability to process clearly, to be able to see what has value, and therefore, as a result of that, to live in accordance with that which has value, and therefore using this breath wisely. So I'm going to approach the paramis from a more practical point of view, because I think today can be for us who are able to stay an opportunity to kind of contemplate and also see how they apply very directly in our practice. First of all, our practice is based on the quality of generosity, and it's a kind of unusual approach to say that it's the generosity of the mind. It's the relinquishing of our attention from all the preoccupations associated with our sense of security and our sense of a survival. It's the relinquishing, again, the reallocating of the energy caught up in that structural way of viewing and perceiving and processing life that then allows for this relinquishment of our attention towards the cultivation of mindfulness, because we all know, in complete honesty in our practice, that most of the time we're sort of here and sort of processing life, right? And so this generosity quality that's associated with, for instance, the support of one like myself who lives, which has surrendered this life to the Dhamma, is emphasized, and that is the kind of the outward giving, you know, that comes from the understanding of the immeasurability of the value of the Dhamma. We can't give it value. So that becomes a contemplation of the heart. And that, it's said, is the first parami because it's the easiest one. Now, easy does not mean that it's easy. But it's the one that all people can understand. And so, particularly in Asia, Dana is emphasized as the primary parami for a lay person, because it's considered that until there's a real purification through the interconnected sense of supporting one another at this very basic level of what's called the requisites, then we can't begin to then see into the development of the sila aspect, the practice concentration aspect, and transcendent understanding wisdom. And so their entire system, especially in villages, is based on this interconnectedness, this entire society that's built around the temple, where those who live in the temple have surrendered their lives to the Dhamma and give this nourishment. And then the lay people support and nourish those who are nourishing them through the Dhamma, through the samadhi and the panya aspect. And it's really very beautiful to witness, having been in a deep forest monastery in Thailand, to just see the joy, the absolute joy in this reciprocal relationship with life, the the radiance that comes to the face is of these villagers bringing their morsels, and of their morsels, the very best of what they have to nourish that which has the highest value. So there is that particular outward expression, which is an inward refinement. Hi, I'm talking about the Paramis. And I'm talking about irony and how they're transcendent, and yet we're looking at them at a practical level. So I'm going to focus, though, more today not on the outward expressions, but the inward expression of Dana as the relinquishment, the offering of that which truly has the highest value in our lives, which is our attention. There is nothing that has more value than our attention, and then, of course, that which informs how we use our attention in this life. Because it's all a matter of attention. And we can begin to see that in our practice. When I do very, very deep intensive practice, you know, with one of these guys that is not interested in anything other than the details of the experience of breathing, you know, for, what, 2 months? You know, that just holds the mind at that level of training until the mind naturally expresses aspects of something other than that clarification of the basic practice of mindfulness. I've seen that really we can take an entire lifetime to develop that relinquishing of capacity of mind to offer that which is of highest value, which is our momentary attention to the practice. Because we can see how elusive it is. It's like a fish in the ocean. Where is this fish going to get its food? Where is it going to be nourished? And suddenly, there's through the factor of faith, there's a sense that we're no longer concerned about where we're going to get nourishment, but where we're going to apply that which has the highest value. So the surrender of attention, the relinquishment of one's attention to the cultivation of mindfulness is a really helpful understanding, practical understanding of an aspect of generosity. Because otherwise there's a withholding, a lack of faith, referring back to that which is conditioned by all kinds of considerations, as we know. I'm making it sound so simple. But things like greed, you know, ill will, you know, we're just, our minds out of clarity, we see, we're amazed, you know. We're so bound. So this generosity is, it said, the first step in understanding how it is that one can actively engage the unbinding from the primary factor that all of these paramis are concerned with, which is craving, and the misunderstandings that come through that particular orientation born of craving and clinging. I could sit and give a Dhamma talk all day on just Dana. To go on to the next parami. The next parami is virtue. Now, virtue is actually a reference given for all the 10. But in particular, virtue is in reference to non-harming. Virtue is in reference to the 5 precepts and the understanding that the essence of this teaching is to keep in mind the fact that there are ways of recognizing that which is harming and to effectively see that it is possible to live with a mind that is intentionally pure by being aware. It's not possible for us to be completely and totally, you know, like finicky about not harming anything. There are these ahimsa monks that are a kind of aberration of this understanding that walk all their lives, and actually the Jain tradition is very big on this, you know, without hurting any living being. So it's a kind of, you know, like this, because it's like, how can you live without, and they even wear masks, you know, so as not to breathe in creatures. It's a very, very specific approach. And it's not really possible to live like that with that kind of phobic sense of non-harming, but more that sense of the gracious heart that understands that it is a virtue, it is something that can guide the development and the maturation of our consciousness and help us to consider our actions, to consider them, and to consider such things as motivation. And to be able to live a more reflective life that isn't reflecting in reference to the states of fear, for instance, and such, but more reflecting out of the growing wisdom that's arising in our practice. And so it's not about being afraid of harming. It's about understanding that there's a way to reflect in life, and that to reflect upon as a means of guidance, to keep that which is harming in mind, in a non-adversarial manner, which is to keep in mind that which clarifies the truth of suffering and the actual causes of suffering and the potential cessation of it in the tiny little ways. Tiny, tiny little ways. And it's so interesting when we keep this in mind, how these tiny little ways become little moments of choice in our lives. This choice of non-harming. And it can be apparent or it can be surprising what kind of brings us to a halt and says, let me consider how I want to approach in this particular situation. And I can give so many examples of this throughout my life, but most recently, and this is not something that had happened for me maybe before, but somehow through, I moved a glass and I heard a bug. And the bug was kind of like, you know, it was sort of like, it looked like it was had become a loss of use of one leg. So I thought, well, how do I respond to this? You know, it's a bug. And yet, here's an opportunity. And so I just sat in reflection, not knowing, really not knowing what to do other than to be aware. And I was actually teaching a retreat. And to be aware, and I just watched all of the conflict in the mind. I heard the bug, you know, what do I do? Take it to a veterinarian? You know, I mean, it's that kind of, you know, what do you do? The helplessness of it. And I just sat there in contemplation of the pain of life, the truth of the suffering of life, and how it's not possible to live without, you know, kind of converging in ways that bring some kind of suffering. But there's a distinction between that and the intention to harm. And there's a distinction between that and our ignorance of that which is harming. And so it became a very powerful contemplation that kind of cleared my heart out at a number of different levels of some inherent conflict that I didn't know that was there. And not to say that this is the expected outcome, but as I was sitting there, the bug started to walk and went away. You know, so I'm not saying that there was any magic. But there are these little tiny moments that it just galvanize our attention in ways that help us to understand and to clarify the fact that it isn't that we are intentionally harmful, but that that does exist in this universe and this interplay of universe. And there's not needing to be any guilt associated with the harm that occurs inadvertently. But it can be a reason for, you know, deep contemplation of the truth of suffering. Renunciation is next, and renunciation is very interesting because we think of renunciation in association with its more extreme. I think the last time I was here I talked about, and I've forgotten the number, but the extreme meaning that we relinquish our lives to the Dhamma in a particular manner by becoming mendicants. And we give our body over and our minds over to the body of the Vinaya, which is the body of the rules and regulations that hold a person within a certain order. And for monks, there are 200 and, forgive me, something around 31, and for nuns, there are 300 and something. And I don't mean that. This is not the kind of renunciation I'm talking about, but the renunciation that has to do with becoming aware of how driven we are by looking for pleasure through the sense doors. The Buddha once asked, you know, is there happiness separate from the sense doors? And that recognition of how much we rely upon pleasant sounds, pleasant sights, pleasant tastes, you know, so forth and so on, particularly in our culture where it's a kind of expectation that we can have, you know, where we have so many different choices and the mind is practicing constantly this sense of, like, what is more pleasurable? And it's a kind of delusion, and that delusion that gets caught in a hall of mirrors called narcissism, particularly in our culture, that's what this life is about. And so we get more and more refined, you know, through our senses. So this is the kind of balance to that. It's not saying that pleasant experience isn't something acceptable, but it brings into consciousness that there's pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral experience. And by including the other two, there's more of a sense of the balance. The balance comes in through the awareness. And therefore, there's that ability to renounce the reliance upon the delusion that somehow our sense doors, the purpose of our sense doors is to detect what is pleasant and to go after it. And that going after it is the opposite of gate, gate, you know, gone beyond. It's the entrapment of the delusionary mind that gets more and more ensnared, more entangled in ignorance. So it's fine to have experiences that are pleasurable. And it's also helpful to be aware of the other two and to help the balance come into play so that we're not just like other little creatures looking for little sweet morsels, you know, but are informed by reason so that we can become reasonable beings, as is the reference for the paramis, when becoming supremely reasonable. I find this very appealing. Becoming reasonable. The wisdom factor is also very important to understand in terms of the distinction between it as an inadvertent outcome over time through to our practice, and its role separate from its actual application in life, because wisdom is not something that I can will, you know, because wisdom, as it grows, is a penetrating factor. First of all, it's discerning. It knows the distinction between and amongst things. Primarily, as the Buddha points out over and over again, please get real. Come into actuality. Become grounded in the foundation of mindfulness here in this fathom-long body. Know whether you're sitting, standing, and walking and lying down. Be aware of which sense door is dominant. Be aware of the distinction between that which is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. This is all possible. And it's that wisdom capacity that is present in this discernment that is able to know. The knowing factor at this very basic level. If we assign our knowing to something transcendent, then we get really, really disabled by it because there's not an actuality here. So this is where I was talking about the irony of this transcendent aspect of our practice and implied, and in particular the wisdom, the ability to penetrate through to see the actual characteristics of life. To actually penetrate through at an intuitive level in a way that completely informs every aspect of our interactive being, cellular, right down to the DNA, our nervous system, the perceptual process of our minds to really be informed by the truth of suffering, or what's, I think, more easily understood as incompleteness. That sense of incompleteness, if we don't have that truth embodied in our consciousness, as well as the truth of impermanence, you know, which is really just working with change and becoming more and more thorough and diligent with beginning, middles, and ends. And as well, the sense that this is a process and not a self. And as the mind begins more refined, especially in practice, in intensive practice, these principles, not at a cognitive level, but begin to clarify our experience. And we have a different perceptual process that begins to guide our understanding. And it's not esoteric, it's practical. We just begin to see things more clearly. But that is not something that the Buddha actually focused on so much. He offered that there are these characteristics and offered definitions, you know, associated with the role of Panya. But what's more important here is the attitude of wisdom. And the attitude of wisdom begins with the intention to have an open mind. And an open mind is a mind that is not processing according to that which is good or bad. But an open mind that keeps expanding beyond that inner authority born of delusion that says, okay, you know, what this process is about is figuring out which is right or wrong and becoming a superior being in the process. But really to move beyond the confines of pride and that belief that somehow this is about right and wrong. And I see this a lot in Dhamma community because I kind of move through the vectors of different traditions and have, you know, students that sit with me from all the Buddhist traditions and have been trained in a few of them. So it's that sense of, like, the delusion that this is about right and wrong. But this is about being able to discern that which leads to suffering and that which leads to freedom, that which allows for us to breathe at a very practical level, that which is unbinding. And so it's, again, each one of these paramis could be an entire day, week, month, year of reflection and study and application. These are little synopses of them. So wisdom is an attitude that's based in the intention to have an open mind, a mind that's open enough, expansive enough, to begin to detect how it is that it narrows everything down to different beliefs that are functioning unconsciously. And you know how deeply caught the sense of self is in right and wrong. So wisdom frees the sense of self from this kind of mission through the admission of the fact that through listening and through receiving other people's views, one can see that there is sameness within view. Looking for sameness rather than difference. A separate sense of self is preoccupied with difference and isn't. Whereas wisdom brings the mind into an attunement with what is. Yes, we are alike. Our process is looking for the same result. And the recognition of that to the point of the compassion where it is that we see ourselves and others stuck. And as well, it's that ability to really allow for us to reevaluate our own belief systems as we become aware of them without then going about the mission of creating a new one. Buddhism is not a belief. There's a cosmological aspect to it associated with different factors that the Buddha presented, but it's not a belief system. And therefore, it is not a religion, and so forth. It's a practical science born of powers of recognition and application of mind. How marvelous. How marvelous. Next, to wisdom is, I have to look at in the order, is energy. And as all of these things that I've been talking about begin to function, again, it becomes clearer about how we apply our energy. And it becomes clearer about how it is that we actually also have a lot of potential to work with energy skillfully and to mature energy into qualities that are helpful in our practice. So energy, sometimes in the more archaic translations, you know, energy can be related to, like, other qualities, like when I'll talk about striving. And, but here, it's a certain, again, irony, where we gather this energy into a more relaxed consciousness, because mind is energy. And then in that more relaxed consciousness, are better able to, again, kind of discern the balances in our life, because a lot of this has to do with balance and we recalibrating our lives through mindfulness. And that balance, you know, of energy and focus. And also becoming more and more open to energy as is expressed through different states, rather than just the energy that I wish I had. And, you know, I like myself when I have this energy, and when I have that energy, you know, I don't like myself. People, I just taught a retreat, and it became really, really clear that we can spend time afraid of the energy state that's present. We're afraid of our own energy, and we kind of amp it up, and we gear it down, and, you know, we manipulate it a lot, rather than recognizing and opening to all energy states and allowing them to become a part of the investigation process of our minds. To be able to investigate different energies and how they relate to different states, and to become more receptive to the fact that they're all energy is something that is constantly changing. And it is also what it is that we are applying through attention. Because attention is kind of like a garden hose. You know, if my attention is over here in the unconsciousness, then all of the water, energy running through that hose, is nourishing the unconsciousness. You know, whereas if it's in semi-consciousness or direct, what we call direct experience, then the energy is like feeding, flowing in to whatever it is that, and the term is bhavana, or cultivating. So energy is something that we can work with by becoming aware of it. So oftentimes in retreat, I'll suggest, you know, let's just become aware of our energy now. It was different than it was an hour ago or this morning, you know, to become aware. And as we become aware of energy, it helps to gather it in a much more, a much broader awareness of our human experience of change. And all energy states can be a part of our all-inclusive awareness without preferring one over the other. It's one way attachment gets really, really strong in our culture, particularly where progress, you know, and Starbucks, and, you know, it's like how we feed ourselves to remain at a certain level of energy. Amazing, huh? So marvelous. Patience is next. And patience, I have to say, in this life is my power me. It's the one that has grabbed my attention most deeply. And I also think it's collectively, potentially, our kind of saving grace power me. And I'll say a little bit more about that just briefly after my reflections on the 10. But patience refines energy. It purifies it. And it as well is related to the fact that it's the antidote to restlessness. And patience and the compassionate factor in patience can kind of open to allow restlessness to be present. It is one of the most difficult aspects of suffering, restlessness, and existential manifestation just breeds restlessness. It exists because we are in existence. And it's born of craving and clinging, just a sense of, like, angst. So patience just has that allowing quality where one becomes truly able to open to all the energy states and all of the mind states as well, and to open out of inquiry, out of curiosity, out of interest. Patience is the capacity to take as long as it is required in order to experience the beginning and middle and the end of something, to really work with the inadvertent understanding that comes to us associated with the truth of anicca, impermanence. Because impermanence is about wholeness, about beginning, middle, and end. And in our culture, we just want the beginning, you know? We're cardinal energy kind of firebirds, and it's like, yeah, to include the entire experience, to include the experience of the beginning, the middle, and the end of this one experience, process of breathing, to include our entire experience and to know it directly, to include our entire life, and to potentially be present in our lives now and through to the very end, to transition, to be present. And again, all of this has a lot of kind of dharma, reflection, implication, teaching that's so fascinating, you know. But just to look at it at a practical level, patience as a parami that allows one to counteract restlessness and anger. We think of metta as the counteracting force, but I'll get to metta. It's slightly different. Patience is able to receive that fire energy and give it the space for it to cool so it's not reactive. So it can be a part of our reasonable intelligence. Patience. Associated with patience, something that's become very interesting for me as a practice is truthfulness. And for me, this is guided by a contemplation of the Buddha. There are these various contemplations of the Buddha. Related to patience, the Buddha never hurried. Now, that didn't mean he didn't go fast, but hurried is different. And so I carry that contemplation with me when I walk in life, so that I can allow life and walking in life to be the same as in retreat. I don't mean that I always go so slow, but to look for that hurried sense, that urgency that kind of disembodies our ourselves from our foundation of mindfulness. Truthfulness is interesting and held in the contemplation that the Buddha reported that for lifetimes, there was the bodhisattva intention to practice telling the truth. And when I heard that and took that in, I began to see how difficult it is and how mindfulness and direct and natural experience, which is so much of our, you know, highlighted in our practice, you know, in retreats, direct experience, becomes skewed and put into a kind of vagueness out of our inability to look at something directly because there's so many defenses within. And that how this relates to speech, I see it within myself. Somebody will say, ask me a question, and I'll start to get the answer, and then suddenly it's going over here. You know? And to kind of pull it back and hear the question and give direct information. There's so much in the process of our minds that keep going, you know, rather than yes, no, maybe, you know, and just the sharing of information. And I remember that when I really took this one on, understanding that it could take lifetimes, that I didn't have to perfect it now, that the Paramis themselves are the perfecting agents, not me. That, you know, I had this dream one time of these two beings, and they were a little bit more amorphic than human, and not so featured, and a little bit more refined, it seemed, more kind of energy bodies. And they were going like that. They came out to each other. And what I understood in my dream was that one had said to the one, "What is your process concerning such and such?" And the other just released the information. There was no withholding. It was just the information related to the question about the process. And I thought, oh, great, that is for me a model. But also, it's a model that one needs to bring into a much more rarefied understanding of one's own mind, that all there is the truth. I don't mean ultimate. We can't go there. This is not gate, gate, hara-sangate, so forth. This is practical. This is why we're here, grounded in this reality, to kind of straighten out the path and get clear and let it be simple and to become reasonable beings. And the beauty of this contemplation and this parami of truthfulness is that we can take it on. We can take all of these on, some more than another. And that's one of the things that I'm going to focus on in my Dhamma talk next week. Just, you know, which ones we can apply directly, which ones are actually, you know, practiced and arise inadvertently. But anyway, so that sense that truthfulness is really interesting rather than critical, because it's one of the karmas. The Buddha said to his son Raula, upon Raula saying to the Buddha, "I want my inheritance." And the Buddha said, "I will give you your inheritance," because he was referring to, you know, "You're a king, I want your money and your kingdoms and so forth." And he kind of stunned the boy by saying, you know, "Your inheritance is the Dhamma, come with me." And actually, you know, who knows the actual story, but, you know, Raula followed his father back to the community of the Sangha. And became a little monk. And the first thing that the Buddha said just about to him was, okay, now your practice is understanding the importance of truth. Never deviate from it, because it is the very basis for the strengthening of all the various factors of the Dhamma. If we can't speak directly to our experience, then everything else is more likely to remain in delusion. It is dangerous not to speak the truth. What is your process associated with something? There's only the information present within what you know about this process. And that's enough. So, truthfulness. After truthfulness is, and it's an interesting place that it takes in the whole progression here, but rather the determination, I like to refer to as resolve. It's that kind of quickening of that sense that comes through time about what is of essence in this life. And so in various suttas, it's talked about how there is this experience of higher consciousness that leads to such qualities. And higher consciousness, I don't mean up there, but here. Expanded consciousness is more effective. That leads one to recognize that there is a way to what's called the holy life, which is a way of viewing and seeing and interacting that is actually in alignment with the truth of suffering, the Four Noble Truths. And resolve, it becomes a kind of protective quickening of the energy of the mind in the direction of that which one intends to cultivate. If there's no resolve, one's kind of sitting there going, oh, I'm going to kind of cultivate mindfulness today. I'm going to kind of tell the truth. You know, I'm going to kind of, sort of, yeah, maybe. You know, resolve is like taking the energy and bringing it into a kind of steady state. So the resolve, for instance, to consider what the truth is in any given moment, therefore to be able to tell it, actually is a kind of stabilizing of the energy so that one can actually see and know and therefore respond accordingly. It's a very important factor in our personal practice. Resolve. I'm cutting back shorter little reflections. But the next is loving kindness. And it's interesting to me that, again, the order of these, because I don't have time to go into the order and how the order and this particular order kind of works together in progression. I mentioned it with Donna, how it is that that's considered to be the first. But all of these are constantly working together, although it's our responsibility to focus on them personally and directly, to be aware of them, and to bring them into our sense of that which is of value. And loving kindness has a great and high value here, because even though we think of it as, you know, metta and we practice it, the profound nature of metta is not the pleasant feeling in the heart, which is so much of what I find when I teach metta retreats, people looking again for the pleasant experience. But it is a force that brings all the maturation of all these different factors into a state that actually has the capacity to do its job, which is to uproot ill will. The Buddha made it very clear that wisdom itself is not able to uproot ill will, only metta. Because it softens the soil of that, you know, very, very deeply rooted hindrance. So loving kindness is excellent and wonderful and affects us and moves through our process, you know, in ways that is endlessly helpful. And it has a very, very specific role in helping us to participate in life in a manner that allows for us to, again, really see how various factors are either wholesome or unwholesome. And here's implied, you know, the teaching of the great efforts, what to effort towards. A friend of mine once said in a group interview, there's either metta or not, isn't there? Well, it's true of a number of these qualities. It's either patience or not, and so forth and so on. So the last here, and again, this could be a month-long retreat on metta that I'm giving a Dhamma talk for in just beginning, because all of this is meant to be contemplated and applied as expressions of mindfulness. So the last is what's referred to as noble upeka, or equanimity. And last meaning is it means that it is present from the first moment of mindfulness, and it brings everything into its maturity. It is the maturing factor associated with all and everything associated with the Dhamma. And it is, again, one of the factors here that can be cultivated directly. It's said that upeka has 11 branches, and these branches kind of just are like a central nervous system to all of the teachings and how they intersect in the support to become a truly and supremely reasonable human being. In this case, balance. In this case, spacious balance. In this case, increasing tolerance for spaciousness and stillness. In this case, the kind of the eradication that comes, and we've experienced it to some degree, of the reactive, impulsive nature that's bred into the nervous system. It's the clearing of that and seeing into how that's all related to some kind of wanting, some kind of clinging, some kind of craving. So at a practical level, it helps us to see how we reach out and want more that is pleasant. I'm eating a meal. Actually, the other day, it was the most delicious egg salad sandwich I had ever had. It was so good. It was better than my mother's, you know. It was like, and I was just eating it and wanting more as I was eating it. And I was looking and thinking, oh my God, as I'm eating it, it's disappearing and I want more. You know? And so I began kind of nibbling around the edges and, you know, just playing with it to keep it adding, you know, lasting longer, because the wanting mind was getting more and more strong as it was, as, you know, I was eating this delicious, the most delicious thing I've ever eaten, I thought. And I was just investigating that sense of like, oh, this is sensory heaven. I don't want it to end. Aversion. I'm going to get averted about this, you know, but meanwhile I was consuming it. It's impermanent. So it's like, what happens is that in our lives we begin to see Dhamma kind of teaching itself through eating an egg salad sandwich, because it's all the same. And upekkha is that process that distills and clarifies that everything is the Dhamma revealing itself, pointing the way to greater clarity and purification in our lives. So this is a little bit about the paramis. And what we're going to be doing today is actually just taking good care of our practice as usual. But you might, for instance, consider, all right, the parami of a patience present as a guide in the practice, as an antidote to restlessness. Mind gets restless, it's time to go home. You know, got to get active here. What am I doing? You know, whatever. Just kind of how the mind deceives itself and entraps itself so that it cannot relinquish its attention. It cannot be generous in offering its attention to the Dhamma. How the sense of that which we value is sometimes something that we will miss the mark in rather than cultivating it. We'll just like say, okay, I value this, but meanwhile I'm going to think about what color I'm going to paint my walls, which is my thing. Green, blue, red, oh, that color, you know. It's sort of like what has the highest value in this moment. Because there's that sense of sila, that which is being cultivated, and renunciation. You know, it's like seeing if the mind is trying to find pleasure in the experience and bring it to neutrality or open to that which is not. Which doesn't mean that pleasant isn't the predominant experience. It is, maybe, but it shifts and changes. These are ways that we might look at our practice today. And the wisdom factor, which is the keeping the open mind. Because if we understand that the mind is trying to figure out good and bad and trying to, you know, resolve the great as imponderables, then we can just open the mind back up and to just see directly what's occurring rather than trying to fulfill that mission of the mind. Am I doing a good job? Am I... You know, am I not? This is not a way of gauging our practice. Right or wrong or good or bad. It's a matter of being present. Energy factor. Just really being aware that energy is constantly changing. And being generous with that opening to all energy states and to notice possible to be present in them. This could be a whole retreat, right? And we just have a day, but we'll plant seeds. We'll plant seeds today. And as well, you know, patience, as I mentioned, patience is just infinitely helpful just in recognizing the wisdom of slowing down. And I'm going to start with that one in terms of just making some suggestions as we begin to practice truthfulness. What is really going on here? How can we open to that? Is it pleasant, unpleasant, neutral? What is the nature of the experience? Just truthfulness is so important as an understanding associated with direct experience. Our thinking can take us into delusion and association, but that isn't where we find truthfulness. Direct experience. And determination, you know, there can be that sense of the balance of energy and focus in all states. Determination is not will. It's really about a much more subtle understanding of how to help the mind to remain steady and persevering. Loving kindness, the attitude of affection with everything that arises, realizing when it is that there is a constriction, and just that retraining of the mind into a non-adversarial receptive awareness. Because, oh my gosh, have you ever just asked yourself, how adversarial do you feel in this moment? It's like, you know, it's like, it's so, you know, I learned it with my children one day with my son. I love my son with all my heart. My intentions and most noble intentions are awake with my son, and I was completely adversarial. You know, it was like I had a sword and was kind of going, quack, 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 quack. And it was unconscious until I just saw, oh, yeah. Have we ever opened to adversarial energy with affection? With affection. And then equanimity. It's that sense of, yeah, it's actually quite simple. It's just being here. It's okay. It's all right. It's okay. Equanimity resonates with this increasing trust that it's okay the way it is. And particularly enoughness, that sense, it's enough. It's enough to be here. There's nothing else that is more important than just being here in this moment with things as they are. It's that mind that says, blah, 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 but it just is, I guess, you know? It just is. It's the settling of the mind into, yeah, that all there is what is in this moment. It is okay in this moment, and it is enough to be present in this moment. All of these have awakened to some degree and are present within the mind stream and can be called upon at a contemplative level and can be applied. How beautiful. How auspicious. And how very simple, if we can let it be. So all of them may not be recognized or contemplated today, but you may wish to consider, you know, what you want to keep in mind. And I'll read them just through once, just for you to sense which one catches your attention most, because throughout lifetimes, it said, we cultivate one or the other parami to a greater degree within each kind of karmic formation in order to fulfill the Dhamma. So that aspect of generosity, surrendering attention, the virtue associated with non-harming, that becomes aware of that which is harming. Renunciation of that belief that it's all supposed to be pleasurable, opening to that which is as well pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. That's a very, very helpful one. The wisdom associated with open, keeping the mind open, and I'm going to add the wisdom of slowing down. The wisdom is always about that which promotes and strengthens the conditions that helps us to be present. Energy just being open to all the energy states with the faith that they are all related to our experience in an acceptable manner, and that they are part of our all-inclusive awareness. Energy is a field called mind, and it has so many different qualities to it. Allowing in energy states that maybe in the past have been judged. Patience. And again, I can join patience with slowing down and opening in a manner that allows for restlessness to exist, allows for discomfort to exist in a way that doesn't then use restlessness as a way to get away from patience. Again, direct experience as an aspect of truthfulness. All there is the truth in this moment. What is it? I don't mean necessarily at a psychological level, but in terms of what it is that you're experiencing right now. You know, what state is present in this moment? And that sense of just perseverance when the mind would otherwise move away. Perseverance, resolve, an attitude of affection with whatever arises. And it sounds really strange, but the possibility of loving life, loving our process, loving this process that is moving towards freedom, loving it. Being grateful when, and loving when suffering arises. An attitude. And equanimity. You know, just that sense. Again, it's okay in this moment. It's okay. Here in the middleness, the metaphor, it's enough to be present. Sometimes we need to use our minds in a reassuring way. It's enough just to be present. And to allow things just to be as they are, just the isness of the moment. And to breathe with this possibility. Breathe in to the okayness, the enoughness, the isness in this moment. So sitting for maybe just a few minutes to let this kind of in a reflective way, and then we'll take a little break.